This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is with us today. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. So if you'd like to talk to Susan, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free. 800-222-9455 is our toll-free number, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She works with clients of all ages and athletes on enhancing health, fitness, and sports performance. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She's also consulting sports dietitian for Illini Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the Division of Campus Recreation ARC Building, that's the Activities and Recreation Center on the Champaign-Urbana campus of the University of Illinois. A member of the American Dietetic Association and the American College of Sports Medicine, she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. Again, questions about diet and nutrition are invited. Those phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Good afternoon. Welcome back.
Welcome back to you, too. It's fun, fun to be here again.
So where would you like to start today?
Well, what I thought would be a good thing to do today would kind of go through a review of some ways to maximize the diet and really take a look back at what our national guidelines call for from the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Those come out every 5 years. That's since about 1980 by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Department of Agriculture, and look at giving particular guidelines for Americans. Many countries have their national nutrition guidelines, and ours are a little bit different but similar to many other ones. So looking at ways that we can kind of implement that in a practical way. In other words, you know, we're all busy. We're all trying to do the best we can diet-wise, but maybe just kind of looking back to say, gosh, are we doing the things that we really want to look at
as
a nation?
Right. Kind of thing. Okay.
Right. So I wanted to go through those and then talk a little bit about some of the research that's backed some of these things up for things. So when we think about maximizing our diet, I think one of the first things is looking at variety, which we've certainly talked about before. Trying to make sure you're getting a good variety in the diet and getting a variety of nutrient-dense foods. And I guess I wouldn't say variety means you're getting chips and Cheetos and crisps and, you know, all those things. But really looking at variety, particularly for fruits and vegetables, because those are two areas where we do know if we can eat a lot of different kinds and different colors, it's going to be a maximum benefit nutritionally for us. So just reminding ourselves that different colors mean different nutrients, different antioxidants are color in the color of the fruits and vegetables. So that's a good way to think about balancing that out. So I think that's number one. Number two is really looking at energy intake. And of course, in the U.S., we tend to, you know, we have tended to over the years eat more than we've expended. So really being aware of that. Now, we have a lot of data and some good studies that have come out that have looked at ways to be a little more accountable for your energy intake or your total calorie intake. And one of the best things we can do to maximize the diet there is to actually track what we eat. So, you know, that might be something that we could encourage listeners to do just periodically, even take 2 or 3 days. And I usually recommend 2 days during the week and 1 weekend day, and jot down what time of day is it, what's the food or liquid that you're taking in, and roughly how much are you taking in. And do that for a few days just to get kind of an idea to see, well, gosh, what am I doing? Many times my clients will come in and I'll have them track beforehand, and they'll come in and they'll say, wow, I didn't realize how much I snack between meals, or I didn't realize that I went 8 hours between eating, for example, or those kinds of things. So that's helpful. And then when we look at doing that within the energy needs, there's a couple easy ways that we can track that online, too, if people are interested in that. One of them is just to go on the Food Guide Pyramid site, the My Pyramid, and that's just www.mypyramid.gov. And that is a great site because you can get on there, you can plug in your age and your gender and your activity level, and you can get an idea for about how many servings of different food groups you need. And then you can also print out forms where you can track your intake and compare them to the servings. So that's a good thing to do. There's also a lot of great information about the DASH eating plan. And the DASH eating plan is really based on research that came out looking at dietary approaches to stopping hypertension and ways to look at decreasing high blood pressure. But it's also a very balanced eating plan. And that was put out by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the NIH. And the website for that, if people are interested in that, is just nhlbi.nih.gov. Or if you just would Google National Institutes of Health, or just Google the DASH diet. And you can come up with that research. And the nice thing about that program and the online program there is there are sample meal plans and ways to eat well. The DASH diet is basically materialized out of the idea that if you are getting more fruits and vegetables, you're getting low-fat dairy, you're not adding a lot of salt, you're having more potassium in the diet, more fiber and modified sugar, not much sugar at all, and you're eating within your calorie level, then many people lose weight doing that. But also if you're dropping your salt intake, of course, that helps a lot of people with high blood pressure. That gets back to one of the dietary guidelines that we have, which is to try to keep your sodium intake to about 2,300 milligrams a day. That's equal to around a teaspoon of salt. And that would be, of course, in anything you add to your food or in anything that's already in food. So the biggest line we think about for maximizing the diet there is trying as much as possible to limit the processed foods. Of course, that's kind of tricky to do, but or being aware that if you even doing simple things, let's say if you're cooking for yourself and if you're not able to prepare a lot of food, maybe you do have canned soup that you use, but use that canned soup and then pull out some frozen veggies and chop those up, and maybe you put two extra cups of frozen veggies in that soup. So instead of only being two cups of soup, you all of a sudden have four cups. So per serving, that cuts the sodium in half. So there are little ways to do things. Even if you really don't have much choice but to use a lot of processed foods, you can bump in some other things that are going to really help in terms of nutrition and decreasing the sodium.
Yeah. In the New York Times magazine yesterday, I read it online, but there was a fascinating story. I don't know if it was the cover story or not because I read it online, but Michael Pollan did a piece about our food situation in this country. And at the end of the article, what he talked about was there apparently is some research or some thinking that goes along this line, that if you cook, you're less likely to have a weight problem. If you take the time to prepare your foods yourself, you are less likely to be overweight.
Yeah. Well, I could see that for a number of reasons. I think number one is if you make the food yourself, a lot of times it's fresher. A lot of times it tastes good to you and you may not be as apt to eat as much of it. And you're also getting the whole process of enjoying the food and taking your time with food and maybe eating more slowly because you're enjoying the food, those kinds of things. And I think if food tastes better, we usually don't need to eat as much of it. Sometimes when we're eating quickly or fast food or highly processed foods, we really don't necessarily always like the taste of it. We're doing it more for the convenience, and we may or may not be very satisfied.
Yeah. Well, apparently if you take the time to prepare food, you know what's in it.
Right.
And so you're thinking about it.
That gets back to a real important point about nutrition in general is it does take a little time and energy. It does take a little time to think things out, to get to the store a little more often. You know, when we think about this whole idea of maximizing the diet, one of the best things we can do is shop more often for groceries. And I think a lot of people, at least a lot of friends of mine and people who are very interested in environmental issues and maybe interested in health, tell me that, gosh, they're shopping so much more than they used to because they're doing a lot more, of course, in the summer, the markets if they can. And a lot of people I know now have gardens who didn't have gardens 2 or 3 years ago even. And so they're getting a lot more of their own fresh food. And people are thinking that they want to cook more fresh. And so they're maybe shopping twice a week instead of once a week because they want fresh produce. And they're trying to get some fresh fish and other things. And when you eat more like that, if you're able to do it, and time-wise you can do that, I think it is a lot more satisfying.
Yeah. Well, okay, we were talking about limiting processed foods.
Mm-hmm.
Is there more?
Yes, there's more.
Okay.
There's more. Another one of the recommendations, and again, this gets back to our kind of dietary guidelines, our national recommendations, is consuming a sufficient amount of fruits and vegetables while staying within energy needs. Now, a sufficient amount could mean a lot of different things, but a good goal is about 5 cups a day. Now, that's not a small amount of fruits and vegetables, but it's also not that difficult to do if you have them around. So, for example, in the morning, if you do have a banana with your cereal, maybe have a half a cup of orange juice, there's two servings, and that really is equal to about a cup and a half or so right there. And if you have a salad with lunch, if you add some baby carrots or some veggie as a snack, it's always good to have some snack during the day that's vegetables. So maybe that's, right now there's all kinds of great cucumbers out there or squash or things, but you know, you think if you just slice some veggies and take them with you to work, or have some fresh fruit. Today I brought red grapes with me, so I had those in the morning. And usually if we've got them with us, we're going to eat them.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to get that 5 cups a day is not really that hard if you plan that out and think about having things like tomato sauce or maybe a V8 or something like that for a snack. Another good thing to do at night is to be aware that you don't have to just have one vegetable with your meal at night. I was thinking back to what I had last night when I was kind of putting some of these things together, and especially now with everything that is available that's so fresh locally, with
mm-hmm.
you know, you might have corn on the cob, and we got a big fresh melon, and that was good, and some friends of ours gave us broccoli from their garden, and so you know, we ended up having a meal with 4 or 5 different types of produce, and to think about doing that, because it may not be typically what we eat as Americans. You know, we usually have a big pasta or rice or potatoes or something like that, and the meat and a little vegetable, but it's really changing the idea. There's a lot of interest right now in saying change your plate and really looking at making half that plate at least as produce. And so if you're able to do that, that's a great thing. I would challenge people to take a week at home, or if they're college students and getting their apartment set up, whatever it might be, take a week and really try to do this every day for a week. Try to get 5 cups of produce every day for a week. And usually if we do that and get used to it, people find, wow, that's not really that hard to do.
Mm-mm.
So that's one of our national guidelines. Part of the reason that's a guideline is because there's a lot of other benefits to doing that. You know, one of our other guidelines here is fiber, getting more fiber in the diet, getting at least 25 grams of fiber a day. Our fiber recommendation is really based on the calories we take in, but we're really trying to shoot for at least 25 grams a day. If you eat more fruits and vegetables, you're going to increase fiber. So your gastrointestinal system is probably going to work better. You're going to be more regular. That's a big benefit. If you get more fruits and vegetables, by and large, most people get more potassium in the diet. And we know that more potassium tends to help with blood pressure regulation. And there was a real interesting study. I brought it along to take a look at here. But there was an interesting study that came out that looked at potassium and looked at the benefits of potassium. Potassium-rich produce helps you stay strong as you get older. So there have been a few studies.
It's important to muscle.
It's important to muscle, right. And so a lot of studies are finding that higher potassium in the diet, people tend to maintain lean body mass or maintain muscle mass, particularly as they get older. And if you look at foods high in potassium, you know, some of them include things that we would think of, like bananas, oranges and orange juice and things like that, but sweet potatoes, tomatoes, beet greens. We have a lot of beets in our garden now, and of course you look at beets and you know they're healthy, but beet greens, potatoes, white beans, prunes, spinach, peaches, apricots, melon, so beans and peas. So those might be things that people can think of, gosh, I like those things. I don't eat that much of them, but I could add those in. And so that's a benefit of maybe adding more of this produce, as you're getting more potassium as well.
Okay. Did you mention sweet potatoes?
Sweet potatoes too, yes,
okay.
Are a very good source.
Let's take a listener's call
okay. Now.
A listener calling in on line 1 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. We eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. Sometimes we buy organic, not always. And I was concerned about what's a good way to get rid of pesticides on produce.
Well, the main thing that you can do is to rinse under cool water. And so if you rinse the fruits and vegetables really well right before you eat them, there's not necessarily need to rinse them until you eat them.
Okay.
But to rinse them is a good idea. You could use some of the sprays. There have been some studies to show that some of the sprays work better than water. Other studies have shown they don't necessarily work better than water. But you want to try to rinse that off as much as you can. The other thing I would consider is maybe take an inventory, like I had mentioned before, kind of tracking your intake periodically. If you took an inventory, and this may vary depending upon where it is in the season or what part of year it is, but you might want to look at which foods you eat a whole lot of. For example, if you're eating a ton of berries now and you're getting most of them local, and one thing to keep in mind is that many of our local farmers, some may be certified organic. Some of them are not certified organic, but they're moving that way. So that's a good question to ask because they still may not be using a lot of pesticides, even if they're not fully certified. And you want probably the two or three main types of produce you eat a lot of. It would probably be worth considering at least buying some of that organic, just because that's a high, you do certainly have a high amount of food that you're eating of that one product. So if you eat apples all the time, it would be worth maybe some of the time at least buying organic apples because that would decrease the exposure. So, or you might have other foods that you just periodically eat. It's probably not worth, you know, may not be worth getting organic.
To me, I've heard of some mixtures that you can make at home to wash produce with.
You can do that too. One thing I've used in the past is mixing lemon juice with water, or even if you have a sink of, you know, water or a bowl of water and putting a little lemon juice in there, that may be helpful.
Okay.
So that's something that I've used before. I don't know, Celeste, if you've used anything else.
I don't know how effective this is, but I know that the Heinz people who make vinegar, they suggest adding a little bit of vinegar to a bowl of water and rinsing your mm-hmm. veggies in that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. Let's take another call, a listener in Whiteheath on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi. I was wondering if you know anything about probiotic tablets.
Yes, probiotic tablets. Well, let me back up for a second and talk a little bit about probiotics. Probiotics are compounds that are either in food or put in food, or you can get them in supplemental form. We usually think of yogurt. So yogurt has probiotic lactobacillus or other bacteria, good bacteria that's added to the product to help you digest food better and add good bacteria to your gut. The reason that's important is because we know that if we have a good amount of bacteria in our gut, we generally digest food better, utilize nutrients better. So it's good for us to have that.
Uh-huh.
So you can get it in yogurt. You can get it in kefir and other types of products like that. And kefir is just more of a pourable type yogurt.
Uh-huh.
Or you can buy it in supplemental forms. And so there are a lot of different companies that make different probiotics in a supplement. Many of them are refrigerated because we think that they might hold better if they're refrigerated. Not every type of product is, but some are. And usually they have a range of different bacteria in them. And so many people use those instead of having something like yogurt. So that's a possibility or something that you might want to do too, particularly if I've found it to be helpful with clients of mine who might have concerns like irritable bowel or maybe more problems with constipation or digestive issues.
Uh-huh.
That those may definitely be beneficial. And different people seem to react differently to different brands of supplemental probiotics. So that might be something you want to look at and try different brands. There's also some interest in saying, well, if you use a certain brand that only has a couple different bacteria in it, would be better to use that some of the time and maybe another brand that has other bacteria in it some of the time to kind of build up the full bacterial strain in your gut.
Would you have to then, if you started using that, would our chances are you'd have to keep using that for a long time or well, just as a regular part of your diet then?
Yeah, I think most people who use the probiotic supplement just include that in their regular regimen. Maybe they have a multivitamin they use. They have, if they're using other supplements, they use the probiotic too. And it's not to say that you'd have to use that every day everybody's going to be different with that or always use it. Again, you may find that you just have a dollop of yogurt and use that some of the time, and maybe some of the time you use a probiotic supplement.
Does any yogurt have that
most,
quality?
Yeah, most yogurts now, you'll read on there, they'll say live active cultures, and that's what you want to look for. And that's another good rule of thumb is maybe to use some different brands of yogurt. Don't use the same brand all the time, because then you'll get different types of varieties of this bacteria.
Oh, I see.
Because they have different, different brands use different bacteria and different types of probiotics that they have in their products. So that's a good way to kind of get a wide range of it. And just as a general rule of thumb, everyone should know that if they're on any kind of antibiotic, that you should definitely either use a probiotic or take in yogurt or kefir every day while you're doing that, and perhaps maybe another week or so after, because a strong antibiotic does kill the good bacteria in our gut as well as other bacteria in the body. So sometimes people have more trouble gastrointestinally after they've been on an antibiotic if they don't use a probiotic during that time.
Now, what would give you a clue if you had too much of this? Would you have a reaction if you had for some reason your system builds up a lot of bacteria and you have too much? Is there a point where you get too much of it? Would you know when that is?
Well, I think it'd be pretty difficult to get too much of the good bacteria if you just took a supplement according to directions.
And if the balance of all that stuff is right in your gut, it takes care of itself.
Right.
Oh, I see. So you don't have to worry about you don't want to take too much, but I mean, you just get a balance and...
Yeah, I would say that the probiotic supplements that are out there are not necessarily huge amounts, and they're not meant to necessarily take more and more and more. It's just the idea that on a daily basis you're getting some good bacteria from something, whether it's a natural food product or that, and there wouldn't necessarily be a reason to increase that.
I just noticed that it usually recommends only one or two of these capsules at a day.
Right,
so
right.
They don't suggest you take a bunch or anything.
No, because usually the idea is you're getting some in there and then the body's using that.
Yeah, why throw your money away?
Right, right.
Exactly. Okay. All right, well, I just thought I'd check.
Yeah, good luck.
About that. Thanks a lot.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line, that number, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener on a cell phone. Line one, hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. I have an adult son who has been diagnosed with MS, and I'm wondering if there are any dietary things that might be helpful. I've done some research and found out that scientists are beginning to think there might be a link between MS and a vitamin D deficiency. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I have certainly read some of the similar type of reports that there may be some link in there. I think what we're finding is that many people are low in vitamin D, and that may play a role in many different disease states much more than we ever thought. And so that would be one thing, if it hasn't already been checked out, to have his vitamin D levels checked, make sure that that's good, make sure he's on a good multivitamin. That would be important. You know, there's also some interest with MS in looking at, are there particular nutrients that might be helpful from an anti-inflammatory standpoint?
Right, that's what I was wondering.
Right. Mm-hmm. So when we look at that, we look definitely at things like fish oil, which may be beneficial. I think any diet, MS, like many, many disease states or many concerns, sometimes will play out differently in each individual. And
right.
So certainly there might be medications that he might be on that would contradict using an anti-inflammatory or might cause a problem with that. So you'd want to check with his doctor for sure before adding anything like this. But that's one thing that people are looking at. Maybe if we can decrease the inflammation, would that be helpful? So things like fish oil, even things like certain spices like cumin or red pepper, and some people may decrease inflammation and may be helpful. And so that's being looked at. And then natural antioxidants, maybe to help with healing. So in those cases, we would look at things like fruits and vegetables, like we've talked about, maybe antioxidants like cherry juice, which there's been some interest in cherry juice and decreasing inflammation at the strong type of cherry juice or pomegranate or those kinds of things that okay. maybe they would play a role. I think another thing that's really important is just, you know, making sure that you're looking at eating consistently throughout the day, getting good nutrition. Just overall good nutrition is helpful because, of course, you're wanting to try to maintain muscle.
He eats very little red meat and has done that for quite some time now.
Well, and that might be worth taking a look, too, just at proteins. If he doesn't eat much red meat, that may be a good thing. And then as long as there's good fish, there's chicken. If he likes fish, that might be something to add.
Right,
Which would be really good, too. So
So
those are some of the things that may be helpful. Even something as simple, we don't often think about it, but with MS, something really simple like staying hydrated. Because if the body's hydrated, the systems tend to work better.
And he said recently that he's noticed he is having a problem with dairy products.
Oh, okay, with digestion.
So I'm worried, you know, about calcium and protein. And when he was a baby, he was allergic to milk. So I don't know if that would go back that far and have some bearing on having MS now.
I don't know.
But soy milk, I guess, would be a good source of calcium for him.
Right.
Okay.
And that would give him some additional protein, too.
Yes.
Which would be good, too. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very
thank
welcome.
You.
Let's take another call, a listener in Savoy on line two. Hi. Line two?
Yes.
Hi. Hi there.
Hello. A friend told me that putting a little red pepper in your food would help keep your cholesterol low. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I also I started to look up red pepper, and I see there's lots of kinds of red pepper, and I went to Wikipedia, and I got totally confused. So if that's so, and if I should be using a little red pepper, what should I buy?
Okay. As far as red pepper itself, being able to eat enough of it to significantly decrease cholesterol, it may have a slight effect, but I don't know that it has a huge effect. Cinnamon has been studied recently to decrease cholesterol, and in those studies, both with aiding in cholesterol reduction and in blood sugar regulation, generally ends up being about a quarter teaspoon of dried cinnamon twice a day in most of those studies. Red pepper in general, though, I would say it certainly might have cholesterol-reducing properties. It's very healthy overall, so even if you choose to use the regular red pepper flakes, that you can just buy anywhere that are basically red pepper flakes, that there have been some benefit to those. Spices in general probably have a lot more medicinal properties than we know about. And just because we're starting to find out.
What was the noun you used? Isins?
Spices.
Oh, spice?
Yeah, just spices overall. Red pepper and dried, just basically red pepper flakes that are dried, have been used in some cases to decrease inflammation in the body too and be helpful in that way. So, but I don't know that I've seen studies to show a significant reduction. It may be out there. But what we've seen more often than not lately has been, you know, the kind of the look at cinnamon and its potential. But so you see a lot of cinnamon encapsulated cinnamon as well as just utilizing cinnamon in the diet.
Okay, so they're not loves. Now the red pepper, I understand, comes in sweet pepper, and it comes in hot pepper, and it comes in. Now capsicum is that?
Yeah, the capsicane is a red pepper spice, or the more of the powdered type of red pepper that's used in some studies, and some of those studies have used that particular variety with decreasing inflammation. Now, with cholesterol, of course, we think that inflammation plays a role with heart disease. And so that may be partly what you're thinking about, too, is that inflammation in the arteries certainly plays a role with perhaps causing a coronary event or precipitating to that. So any way we can decrease inflammation in the body, we think that that may decrease our risk of heart disease, too.
Now, I've looked in two stores so far, and all I find are dried red flakes. Or paprika. Are either one of those capsicane?
I think that you'd find certain amounts. I don't know the percentages of capsicane in both of those, but I know that those have both been used in different studies. And so I wouldn't be as concerned about the type of red pepper. I would say that using more red pepper probably is helpful if you can tolerate it, if it doesn't bother your stomach, if, you know, doesn't give you heartburn or anything like that. that there may be a lot more benefits to using that just because it is a strong spice.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Champaign waiting for us on line 3. Hello.
It might be me, huh?
That's you.
Okay. I have seen a book in the bookstore about setting your diet according to your blood type. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, the blood type diet book has been around for a little while, and I think it kind of ebbs and flows with the interest that it gets. But the thinking is that, you know, based upon your blood type, there are certain foods that you may digest better, utilize better, that work better with your body. And it has been looked at in terms of scientific research. I will say that most nutrition scientists don't necessarily think that it's necessary to do that from your blood type factor. But there are people, and I've had clients who seem to feel better doing it and feel that it works for them. One of the concerns with the blood type diet, like some diets, is that many of the different diet plans, depending upon your blood type, may be pretty restrictive. And they might actually have a lot of foods that you really don't like and you wouldn't necessarily eat. And so sometimes people will come to me and say, gosh, I'm doing this, but I hate this food. I feel terrible on it, but I'm doing it because it says this is my blood type. And then I say, well, it's probably not the thing that's going to work for you. And I might have other people who come and say, I feel better on this. I don't know if it's psychological or if it's really true. As long as we can balance out the diet and it works for them, I think it's fine. But there's not a lot of data to indicate that it's a necessary diet and that for sure people are going to do best on that diet. And so it's pretty controversial.
Okay. Let's take another call. Listener on line 1 in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I'm curious if you have been learning anything about Chinese wolfberry berries called goji berries. They're supposed to have high antioxidant properties.
Yes, there's certainly been a lot of interest in goji berries. And the last review I read on goji berries compared them positively to things like pomegranate and things like grape seed extract and very high antioxidant fruits. In fact, I saw one review that said, well, they certainly may be beneficial, maybe as beneficial or very similar to blueberries. And so I don't know that we know that they're necessarily so much better than these other high antioxidant fruits and vegetables, but certainly they may be a good part of the diet in addition to what you're already doing. They're not as available necessarily. I think they're pretty expensive or can be. Yeah. And so I tell people, you know, there's not a real good reason yet to say you're going to do this instead of other things. It was kind of like when pomegranates came out and that was really the thing a few years ago and people stopped eating other berries and started eating those only. And now we know, gosh, they're helpful, but let's keep eating strawberries and blueberries and raspberries and blackberries and all those things that we know are good too. So I think I'd see it in the same context. That I wouldn't say it's a lot better, but certainly they seem to be very healthy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She's a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She's also consulting sports dietitian for Illini Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the new, well, I guess it's really not all that new anymore. The Division of Campus Recreation, ARC Building, the Activities and Recreation Center on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Listeners, if you've got questions about diet, nutrition, give us a call and talk to Susan. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, what's new at the Division of Campus Recreation Activities and Recreation Center?
Well, actually, we're just getting ready. Stacy Krozik, who's another dietitian who teaches classes there and works at the National Soy Research Lab on campus here at Illinois, she and I are both putting together the classes that will be offered for this year. So I can say that there will be some really interesting cooking classes over there, and everything from Mediterranean cooking to, there's going to be a beginning vegetarian class that Stacy's teaching. Then I'm going to be teaching a course with my student interns on a vegan meal. So it'll be all animal-free meal with that. Other classes will be things like five-ingredient meals, So how do you get some, main dishes with just very quick 5 ingredients in there? And there's going to be an Italian night. That's coming September 17th. And so that's something people can sign up for ahead of time. And actually, one of my interns, Allie, is her parents run an Italian restaurant in the Chicago area, and she's helped put that class together. So so there's going to be some really neat things going on. And there's always Stacy also runs some classes about healthy cooking for families with kids and more quick college cooking. And so I think for people really interested in trying to, all the classes are healthy, but they're also going to have some other bend and they also taste good. So that's really what we're looking for there. It's not just a cooking class on a particular type of cuisine. It would be more related to how this is also healthy, quick, easy, preferably low cost.
Economical, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Well, let's take another call. A listener in Muhammad on line one. Hi.
Yes, thank you so much. I have two questions. I heard a doctor say the other day that if you're going to eat tuna, you should heat it to get rid of the mercury. And the second question I heard is if you cook your vegetables on the stove, you lose most of the minerals and vitamins in them. And if that's true, how else should you fix them?
Well, to answer your first question, I have not heard or seen data to indicate that if you, cook the fish, you get rid of the mercury or anything like that. So the main thing you can do to keep your mercury level down is choose fish that are low mercury fish. And twice a week, to have fish twice a week is recommended. And certainly we don't think that that's going to pose any problems. So even if the types of fish we tend to eat, like tuna or salmon or tilapia or cod or things like that, are not necessarily high mercury fish. And so a 3-ounce portion twice a week for most people, unless you're pregnant or have some other concern, is very reasonable.
Oh, okay. So it's okay. But sometimes I eat it more than twice a week.
Right. Well, and tuna, for example, if you have canned light tuna, that's lower in mercury than white tuna.
Oh.
So actually the albacore has higher mercury.
Oh.
But even 3 times a week would be reasonable. I don't think that's an amount that most people have to worry about.
Okay.
And to get to your vegetable question, definitely we know if we eat the vegetables raw, that's great. We know that if we steam cook them quickly, that's a good way to do it. So not have them sitting in water, but buy a little steamer that you can put into a pan, put a little water on the bottom, and maybe steam cook them for a minute or two so that they're
just
still
heat them up.
Right.
Or
cook them in the microwave. You could cook them for a minute with a little water in the bottom with a bowl and put a top on it, and they steam cook for about a minute, minute and a half in the microwave. That's a great way to cook it where you maintain most of the nutrients.
Oh, good.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're very welcome. And that does it for that caller. I want to thank her for calling in this afternoon. No one waiting at the moment. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess with the fish, we've been told that the larger fish are going to contain, they're going to harbor more of the pollutants that we don't want. So I guess one rule of thumb would be littler fish.
Right. Right.
Littler fish.
Yeah, littler fish is a great way to think about it. And fish that, some of the highest mercury ones are things like shark and these, again, the real big fish that we wouldn't, tend to eat. And, there's some concern, too, about pollutants in fish. I think I saw a review that came out, maybe it was in yesterday's paper, looking at how clean the rivers are, the waters, bodies of water, and it didn't look too great for Illinois, as I recall. And that's another thing to think about is where your fish are coming from and is it, pollutants besides mercury or other things that we might be concerned about. But most of the time from around here, we don't tend to eat so much fish that it's a big problem either, just because we don't have.
Yeah. And, we know that omega-3 fatty acids are important, and we can get some of them through plants like flax seeds, right?
Right.
And what else?
Right.
What are the sources?
Soybeans.
Nuts?
Yeah, you get some omega-3 type fats in nuts and seeds and soybeans. Edamame, for example, or roasted soy nuts is another good way. Walnuts is a great place to get nuts as the highest omega-3 nut. Walnuts would be considered a good source with that. And just thinking that using more good fats, more olive oil, more Italian-type dressing, things like that, not as many creamy fats, is another benefit. But I think it is important to look at, there have been study after study looking at omega-3 fatty acid intake and how in particular cultures, like in a review came out with looking at Japanese culture compared to our culture, and how omega-3 fatty acid in the blood is considerably higher in cultures where people do eat more fish. But we do have to make sure, again, that it's hopefully not a high mercury fish. But for some people who don't eat fish at all, they may use some of these vegetarian sources or maybe look at a fish oil supplement, if particularly if they're at high risk for heart disease or some other things where it might be a big help.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Chicago on line 4. Hi.
I heard another health program over the weekend, and a couple of doctors were talking about the more significant importance of vitamin D3, even up to 10,000 units a day. They were reporting some ladies that were, when they said the reading on D3 was so low, it was like under 10, and then it was said it should be up around the range of 30, 40. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, have you thought of that thing they mentioned, 10,000 units a day to build up and maintain a sufficient benefit from D3, which they're discovering is that a whole host of benefits. Could you comment on any of that?
Well, yeah, definitely with vitamin D, and particularly D3, if it's clinically low, you know, again, we say, yeah, below 20 or 30, or depends on the person, but you're going to need larger amounts to get that up. Now, the 10,000 I use a day under the care of a physician and for a certain length of time may not be that unusual if somebody's extremely low, because we know we want to get those D levels up. And so I think that points to the fact of how important it is to get your vitamin D tested, your D levels tested. Yeah, so that's a really good point. I think if it's low, just getting 1,000 IUs for a lot of people may not be enough to bring that up. So it's going to have to be higher amounts.
Let's take another call, a listener in on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I am about to turn 60, and all of a sudden I just find that I'm losing all my muscle. And I've read about these bioidentical hormone-like substances that people are taking. I have no idea where you even get these things or if you have to have a prescription. But can you speak to that?
Well, yeah. There was actually, I think, an article in the Champaign paper this Sunday talking a little bit about that, or this week talking about that. And I think there are, you know, two things to think about. There's the idea that utilizing hormones through your general practitioner, your general physician, if needed, for some people can be helpful. And I think what this review was talking about in the paper was how right away we tended to think, women in particular, when they went through menopause, now were more concerned, and fewer women were taking hormones because of the women's health study concerns and things several years back. And now we're kind of moving back towards, gosh, maybe there are more benefits than we thought, and to take a closer look at that. So whether that's through your physician with hormones that would be prescribed, or this whole idea of bioidentical hormones, there are practitioners who are more what we would consider, I guess, anti-aging practitioners who are around and doing more of this type of hormones. And it is a little bit different. The question is, and I'm not an expert in this area, but what comes up sometimes with the questions would be, do we know as much about them? Do we know as much about the safety? Those kinds of things. Not to say we don't, because again, that wouldn't be something I'm an expert in, but it would be something that you could definitely look into. I would consider talking to your physician first about that and then finding out. But in most communities now, there are people doing this type of work with bioidentical hormones. And so it seems like it's another alternative thing to look at, and might be worth pursuing for you to look into.
Okay, I hope that helps. And here we'll wrap things up with Susan. We're out of time, and rather than invite other people to call in and then frustrate them by having them wait and not get in, we'll wrap it up here. And so that's our August show, and we'll see you in September, huh?
See you in September.
All right, very good. Susan Kundrat is a licensed registered dietitian. She is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. You'll find her online at www.nutritiononthemove.net. She is also at www.rkteamnutrition.net. She's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips, the publisher of that book, Coach's Choice. There we will wrap it up, and Susan will be back with us next month, September, and I think it will be the I don't know if it will be. It won't be the first Monday because I believe that's Labor Day.
I think so.
So stay tuned and we'll let you know when Susan will be back next.